Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, April 15th, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Looking at the front page of the Gazette today, three big stories. First one is Caitlin Clark's rising star brings economic jolt. Second story, retailers warn of unintended effects of hemp bill. Third story, how often are the state's rivers cleaned? And we'll kick it off with the story about Caitlin Clark. Study says Iowa impact from women's program, $14.4 million or more. And this is from John Steppy of the Gazette. Almost everything Caitlin Clark did this month at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse during the NCAA's Final Four had a number to it. In the semifinals, 21 points, 9 rebounds, and 7 assists. The next day, more than 11,000 fans attended the pre-championship open practices, not all to see Clark, but a sizable portion had an obvious interest in the Iowa Stars' every move. The day after that, a record-breaking 18.9 million TV viewers watched her in the national championship game. More than 500 miles away, Clark was making a big impact with different numbers, economic impact for the Iowa City area. It's been pretty easy to see what's been going on here from our standpoint over the last couple of years with the increase in visitation, hotels, restaurants, and dining, said Josh Schomburger, president of Think Iowa City, the area's convention and visitors bureau. It's nothing short of substantial, he said. The Iowa branch of the Common Sense Institute, a research organization, quote, dedicated to the protection and promotion of Iowa's economy, tried to quantify the economic impact of Clark's stardom. The report estimated that attendance from Iowa women's basketball games during Clark's tenure has contributed between $14.4 million and $52.3 million to the state's economy. The wide range in the estimate accounts for whether the money spent by residents on Iowa women's basketball would otherwise have been spent elsewhere in the state's economy. The $14.4 million number assumes that all of the spending by residents is, quote, simply a reallocation of money game attendees would have spent on something else within Iowa, unquote. The $52.3 million figure assumes the opposite. All resident spending is new spending. The truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, the report said. The study used estimates from Think Iowa City that out-of-town attendees who need lodging spend $227.50 on average in the Iowa economy when seeing an Iowa women's basketball game. If a visitor does not need lodging, that average goes down to $133.75. As Clark has soared in popularity across the country, so has the percentage of people coming from out of state to see the Hawkeyes at Carver Hawkeye Arena. Think Iowa City estimated the proportion of out-of-state attendees rose from 10.3% in 2018-19 to 14.8% in 2023-24. The percentage increase is especially impressive, considering that it all happened while overall attendance more than doubled. The Common Sense Institute report specifically is focused on games attendance and its economic impact, but the local economy has benefited in other ways. Take what happened April 1st, a Monday, when the Hawkeyes played LSU in the Elite Eight. Monday is usually the slowest day of the week in bars and restaurants, and it was just packed everywhere, said Brian Flynn, who owns Joe's Place in Iowa City, as well as Tin Roost and Field Day Brewing in North Liberty, and other area restaurants and bars. Fellow local restaurateur Matt Swift said Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City on a typical Monday night maybe had 100 guests come through or 50 guests come through. And there's 500 people there to watch the game, all united and freaking out and so fun, Swift said of the Elite Eight crowd in the brewery. It's been the most incredible thing. It's reached the point where Flynn's restaurants and bars sometimes have to schedule and staff up and be prepared basically like it's a football game. Restaurants and bars also saw an opportunity to potentially convert customers who come for Iowa women's basketballs into customers who will return even when Iowa is not playing. It's a chance for exposure all the time, Flynn said. Somebody goes there for the first time, and you want their first time to be amazing. You want them to go, "That's on my route," as you will with a lot of people. It's not always been like this for Iowa women's basketball games. Swift said 3 years ago, there might have been one to three tables of people specifically there to see the Iowa women's basketball game. The game typically would be on Big Grove's projector screen, but the interaction was pretty low. Now it's a full house. It's a massive difference, Swift said. Clark will be off to the WNBA this summer, but Swift and others have plenty of optimism that the energy around Iowa women's basketball, and consequently the economic impact, is here to stay. I think the buzz is going to continue, Swift said. It might not be fever pitch, but I think those teams are going to be good for a long time. And then it's got photos of fans gathering on the court April 10th, getting autographs from the women's basketball team, and other shots of the Iowa women. Our next story. Retailers warn of unintended effects in hemp bill. Other states offer more sensible regulation, they say. This is from Tom Barton of the Gazette. Iowa consumable hemp retailers warn legislation recently passed by the legislature that's awaiting Governor Kim Reynolds' signature will have, quote, devastating consequences for the consumable hemp market in Iowa. Rick Wagaman owns HW CBD in West Des Moines. The business sells a variety of hemp products, including gummies, drinks, capsules, soft gels, oils, balms, lotions, and creams. Lawmakers earlier this month passed House File 2605 that would restrict the potency of hemp-derived products sold in Iowa and place several regulations on retailers. Under the bill, products would be limited to less than 4 milligrams of THC per serving and 10 milligrams per package. THC is the main active chemical in cannabis that causes a high. Consumable hemp products were legalized in the 2018 Federal Farm Bill and later the Iowa Hemp Act. The laws allow for the sale of hemp products that contain less than 0.3% THC by weight. The laws were intended to address sales of non-intoxicating compounds, such as CBD, but they also legalize the sale of hemp-derived THC products that have a similar psychoactive effect to traditional marijuana. Products containing THC sold at shops and bars generally range from 2.5 milligrams to 10 milligrams per serving, but some contain higher concentrations. The legislation would not only affect intoxicating products, but also those sold for therapeutic purposes. Wagaman asserts by lumping hemp-derived THC products with psychoactive effects under the same definition as non-intoxicating consumable hemp products, the bill effectively restricts access to safe, legal products. It will make it impossible, next to impossible rather, to provide our thousands of customers with the non-intoxicating legal consumable hemp products they've come to depend on for years now, Wagaman said. Yes, we agree there are loopholes that need to be fixed, but the language in this bill throws the baby out with the bathwater. If signed into law, the regulations would take effect July 1. Reynolds' office did not respond to a request for comment on Friday. In addition to imposing a THC cap on hemp products, the bill would ban the use and sale of any consumable products, including non-psychoactive CBD, to anyone under the age of 21. The bill includes civil and criminal penalties for businesses that sell consumable hemp without first registering with the state. It would also allow the State Health and Human Services Department to confiscate non-compliant products from retailers. Synthetic THC would be banned, and retailers would need to attach a warning label to consumable hemp products. Republican Senator Dan Dawson of Council Bluffs said during floor debate that the bill was desperately needed to regulate the consumable hemp industry. Republican supporters of the bill have said they did not intend to legalize intoxicating products when they passed the Iowa Hemp Act in 2019. Quote, in the last 4 years, we've seen the Iowa Hemp Act metastasize into some things we expected and some things we didn't expect, Dawson said. Now we're here today with a bill before us to try to put some desperately needed regulations on the industry, unquote. Dawson did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Friday. Rebecca Ramker, that's R-A-M-K-E-R, owns several CBD stores in Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and the Quad Cities. Like Wagaman, she is licensed by the state and sells a mix of full and broad-spectrum CBD products. The former includes a small amount of THC. She said all products sold are third-party lab-tested and certified organic. Consumable hemp products naturally have trace amounts of THC that grow within the hemp plant. And while most of the products she sells have less than 4 milligrams of THC per serving, a traditional container, which provides a 30-day supply of product, contains 30 milligrams to 60 milligrams of THC on average, well above the 10-milligram cap included in the legislation. That would bring it down to 4 to 5 gummies in a pack, compared to 30 right now, Ramker said. Suppliers would not repackage their products, she said, making it difficult for retailers to find products that fit Iowa's laws. That's going to make it more expensive for us and hit the pockets of consumers, which is very sad, Ramker said. It's going to be costly. She estimated the legislation would affect 70% of the non-intoxicating products sold in her stores. She said the business serves about 800 customers a month of all ages who use the products for treating anxiety, depression, seizures, and difficulty sleeping, as well as for pain management. Ramker and Wagaman agree guardrails are necessary to regulate THC-intoxicating products, and age restrictions should be implemented to ensure responsible consumption. Quote, however, it's essential to recognize that many Iowa families rely on these products for their therapeutic benefits, and criminalizing access to these products would disproportionately harm those Iowans, Wagaman said. Furthermore, both federal and state laws recognize the right of Iowans to access consumable hemp products safely and legally, rather than enacting sweeping measures that inadvertently restrict access to beneficial products. Policymakers should focus on crafting targeted regulations that safeguard public health while preserving access to non-intoxicating hemp derivatives. Industry representatives argue that that approach ensures that customers can continue to benefit from the therapeutic properties of hemp without undue restrictions. The problem is the people in Des Moines would not give us the opportunity to educate them, Ramker said. She, Wagaman, and others in Iowa's hemp industry note that Georgia recently passed a bipartisan hemp law by working with the industry to create a sensible regulation. The Georgia law requires testing for hemp-infused edibles, drinks, and other consumable hemp products and restrict their sales to those 21 years of age and older. The measure requires that those that sell or manufacture hemp edibles, gummies, oils, and other products must obtain a license from the state. And state-licensed labs must test products to measure the amount of THC, CBD, CBDA, and other cannabinoids and ensure that they are properly labeled, Axios reported. Wagaman and Mike Thorson, owner of Don't Worry, Be Hempy in Cedar Rapids, said the lack of definition between psychoactive and non-psychoactive products in the bill creates confusion and uncertainty among businesses and consumers alike, hindering economic growth of a burgeoning industry. Thorson said he has shelved plans to open a second store in Cedar Rapids because of uncertainty over how the legislation will impact Iowa's consumable hemp market. It makes it very hard for shop owners like myself or manufacturers to know what's going on, he said. Wagaman said the state stands to lose tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue by forcing consumers in Iowa to go to neighboring states or online to get the non-intoxicating wellness products that are legal across the country. Quote, It's essential that the governor's office truly understand the impact of House File 2605 to ensure that it accurately reflects the intended scope of regulation without unfairly penalizing the consumable hemp market in Iowa, he said. Next story from the front page. How often are the state's rivers cleaned? Why is garbage removed and natural debris left behind? Think of the last time you enjoyed what an Iowa river had to offer. Did you see trash? Were there downed trees in the water? Jerry Hocken wondered about cleanup of Iowa's rivers. He wrote to Curious Iowa, a series from the Gazette, that answers readers' questions about our state, its people, and the culture. I see a lot of dead trees and other debris, he wrote. Mother Earth would appreciate cleaning efforts. In this installment of Curious Iowa, we look at river cleanup projects and why natural debris is usually left alone. Trash and debris are removed from Iowa's rivers through volunteer-led cleanup projects. River cleaning projects can range in length from an afternoon to a week-long excursion, and they attract volunteers of all ages. One of the most well-known volunteer river cleanup projects is Iowa Project AWARE, which stands for a Watershed Awareness River Expedition. For 21 years, the annual week-long river cleanup has brought packs of volunteers around the state to remove trash from Iowa's rivers. Every year, they pick a different river to traverse. In total, Iowa Project AWARE has cleaned more than 1,400 river miles and picked up 490 tons of trash. Of the trash that has been removed, 81% of it was recycled. The event has inspired 50 additional cleanup events. The idea started in 2003 after Brian Sonnen, who worked for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources at the time, heard that Living Lands and Waters founder Chad Pergracki speak about cleaning the Mississippi River. Inspired, Sonnen pitched a large river cleanup, and the project started within the Iowa DNR. Today, Iowa Project AWARE operates a 501c3 nonprofit organization called N-Compass, which is based in Marion. Iowa Project AWARE maintains partnerships with the Iowa DNR, the State Hygienic Lab at the University of Iowa, county conservation boards, and others. There are other long-running river cleanups. For example, the Cedar River Festival has been around decades longer than Iowa Project AWARE. These annual programs naturally develop camaraderie between volunteers and keep folks coming back. Many say it's like summer camp. At night, you camp. During the day, you float down a river, experiencing Iowa's natural beauty, picking up styrofoam, plastic bottles, and tires along the way. The great thing about river cleanup is it allows everybody, regardless of what background you might have, to see how these rivers function from the seat of a canoe, Sonnen said. Volunteers skim the surface, pick items from the sandbar, or excavate items buried in the river. Sonnen said, "We will go out and scout a river ahead of time. And you get two or three people going down, and they'll be like, we saw a few things, but we didn't see a bunch. And all of a sudden, you send a couple hundred people down, and it's like, man, where did all that garbage come from?" Sonnen said garbage enters rivers in a few ways. First, there's what he calls legacy garbage that was put into rivers before landfills and transfer stations were organized. There also used to be a practice of using tires for stream bank stabilization. As the structures aged, or if tires weren't properly installed, hundreds of tires would deposit into rivers. Natural disasters and floods can sweep items away, and other times, people deliberately dump items into rivers. The behaviors of these bad actors is what Project AWARE aims to change. In 2022, a meat locker filled with rotting meat was pulled out of the Des Moines River. In 2007, volunteers got creative while removing an engine block from the Raccoon River. To get it loaded, he said, they flooded the canoe so that it sank down into the water. Then they were able to use a little bit of buoyancy, whatever muscle, to get the motor in the canoe and then they bailed the water out to get it to float again. Iowa is known as one of the most biologically altered states, meaning its land has been changed for cities, roads, cropland, and other uses. Iowa's river corridors provide wilderness, but Sonnen said garbage in the rivers is a symbol of how we view our rivers. We cannot take our water for granted, he said. Don Clow has been involved with Five Seasons ski team in Cedar Rapids for 40 years. He operates the boats that pull the team while they assemble pyramids and other impressive feats. The team, Clow said, is on the Cedar River 4 days a week for hours at a time. This year, he noticed several large logs upstream from the team's show site at Ellis Park. While the team has been able to work around the logs, Clow pointed out that Iowa's weather and ongoing drought play into river conditions. Usually in the spring, floods clean the river out and also ice cleans it out. It's an annual cleaning process. And of course, the last several years, we haven't had much of an ice out. Clow also noted that flow rates have been low, which also affects the movement of debris. Additionally, low stream flow negatively impacts the habitat of organisms living in rivers. Annual flooding is important for maintaining a healthy river, but Iowa has been experiencing drought for a few years. While the ski team has seen some effects of the drought, debris buildup has not caused a show to be canceled. Clow said he's hoping for a spring flood to help maintain the channel. In the spring, we should have flow rates a couple of flood crests of 30 to 35,000 cubic feet a second, he said. And this year, I think the highest we've been is just a little over 3,000. It's true. According to USGS data, the highest flow rate recorded for the Cedar River this year was April 2nd at 3,350 cubic feet per second. In 2023, it peaked on May 20 with 15,100 cubic feet per second. We're kind of in this drought pattern, he said. We're losing that cleaning aspect, and eventually this will build up. While those who use the river, such as the ski team, are cautious of logs, natural debris is not commonly removed from rivers. State Conservation Officer Ron Lane said natural debris will be removed if it impedes navigation. Sometimes recreational groups, such as paddling and fishing groups, will conduct river cleanups and log removals. When they do these projects, they try to do them in the winter on the ice, so it's easier to cut the logs apart with chainsaws, so they are smaller, so they sink or break apart, he said in an email. Sonnen said natural debris is left alone during Iowa Project Aware cleanups. Log jams and natural things like that, we in general do not remove or really modify because rivers are supposed to have that stuff in them, he said. That's a natural part of the river. It's a habitat for the whole food chain. Sonnen said there are some man-made objects that the project will leave behind, like lumber and bricks. Those are made from natural materials, so they're aesthetically unpleasing, but the idea is that they'll naturally degrade. If they come out of the river, they go into a garbage can and then fill up a landfill. What are the upcoming river cleanups? Confluence Brewing is hosting a Grays Lake watershed cleanup on Earth Day. That's April 20th in Des Moines. And Iowa Project Aware will be cleaning the Skunk River July 7 through 12. Volunteers will cover 10 to 19 miles of river daily and will camp in the Lake Darling State Park in Brighton and the Oakland Mills Park in Mount Pleasant. You do not need to have a canoe or know how to canoe. To get involved, you can go to this website, iowaprojectaware.org. Our next story, suit says police negligent before women's murder. This is by Clark Kaufman of the Capital Dispatch. Bellevue City Police are being sued for allegedly contributing to a woman's murder by repeatedly failing to enforce an arrest warrant and a restraining order against the victim's estranged husband. A federal lawsuit was filed by the family of the late Angela Marie Pritchard, who was shot and killed by her estranged husband, Christopher Pritchard, in 2022. The A lawsuit claims the killing was the result of a state-created danger that was caused by the malfeasance, reckless, or intentional behavior of the Bellevue Police Department. It accuses city police officers of, quote, showing favoritism toward Christopher Pritchard, and that his relationship with the police in the Eastern Iowa community, quote, enabled and fostered his ability to murder his estranged spouse, Angela Marie Pritchard, unquote. According to the lawsuit, Christopher Pritchard was arrested in November 2019 on a charge of first-degree theft. The police allegedly acquiesced to his release on bail and to 31 continuances in the case over the next 4 years. Those continuances, the lawsuit claims, enabled Christopher Pritchard to remain free of custody and emboldened him to repeatedly harass and assault Angela Marie Pritchard. The police department's actions were allegedly influenced because Christopher Pritchard had, quote, a personal relationship with one or more of the city police officers and provided officers with electrical services at no cost or for a reduced fee. Court records indicate that on April 18, 2022, Christopher Pritchard was arrested for domestic violence against Angela Pritchard, and a no-contact order was issued in the case. A few months later, Angela Pritchard allegedly located a tracking device in her Jeep, as well as two hidden cameras that had been placed in her home. Those are potential violations of Iowa's anti-stalking and invasion of privacy laws. Angela Pritchard notified the Bellevue police, and according to the lawsuit, the police, quote, refused to enforce the law. August 23, 2022, the lawsuit alleges, Christopher Pritchard sent threatening text messages to Angela Pritchard stating, quote, it's going to get real effing ugly, unquote. Angela Pritchard allegedly notified the police, who took no action in the matter. August 28, 2022, the lawsuit alleges, Christopher Pritchard told Angela Pritchard he intended to, quote, destroy her business, which led to another police complaint that resulted in no enforcement action. September 1, 2022, a temporary restraining order intended to shield Angela from any further contact from Christopher was filed. The next day, she asked for police assistance in going back to her house after her husband moved out. Police allegedly found that the doors to the house were bolted, utilities had been shut off, and the home was vandalized. The lawsuit alleges the police refused to arrest Christopher Pritchard for violating the temporary restraining order. September 7, 2022, Angela allegedly contacted Bellevue Police Chief Dennis Schroeder to report that Christopher Pritchard had violated the restraining order by going to her workplace and cutting the grass. Schroeder allegedly refused to enforce the order and instead advised Angela Pritchard to contact an attorney. Days later, Christopher Pritchard allegedly confronted his wife at a gas station and simply stared at her. The lawsuit claims police refused to arrest Christopher Pritchard, stating that it was a small town and such encounters were to be expected. In the second week of September 2022, Christopher Pritchard allegedly drove past Angela Pritchard's home several times, including one instance in which he drove by six times in an hour. Again, the lawsuit alleges the police were informed but refused to act. September 12, 2022, Christopher Pritchard went to Angela Pritchard's home to complain about credit cards that he claimed she had opened in his name. The police were contacted and an officer responded but allegedly declined to make an arrest. The next day, Angela Pritchard provided the police with text messages sent from Christopher Pritchard in violation of the court's restraining order, and no arrest was made, the lawsuit claims. September 15, 2022, Christopher Pritchard spent one night in jail after Angela Pritchard showed police a text message that he had reportedly sent her. According to the lawsuit, Christopher Pritchard then placed in his shop windows signs that made negative comments about Angela Pritchard in violation of the restraining order. An officer allegedly went to the shop and observed the signs, but did not arrest Christopher Pritchard. September 23, 2022, Christopher Pritchard failed to show up for a court hearing. 6 days later, he failed to appear for a second hearing and was ordered to turn himself in to begin a 6-day jail sentence. Court records show that Christopher Pritchard failed to turn himself in and a warrant was issued for his arrest. Quote, despite knowing Christopher Pritchard's usual whereabouts in a small town of under 2,500 people and the unique vehicle he drove, which was a black 2-door Jeep Wrangler with ODARK-30 license plates, the defendants flat out refused to enforce the warrant and arrest Christopher Pritchard, unquote, the lawsuit states. Shortly before 8 a.m. October 8, 2022, the Jackson County Sheriff's Office responded to a 911 call from the Mississippi Ridge Kennels where Angela worked. When police arrived, she was found dead from a gunshot wound to the chest. She was 55 years old. The next day, Christopher Pritchard was located in a Jackson County residence with the murder weapon and ammunition still in his possession. He was later convicted of first-degree murder. The lawsuit seeks damages for violations of due process rights through a state-created danger, violations of state law regarding the enforcement of no-contact orders, and intentional infliction of emotional distress and loss of consortium. The lawsuit also seeks damages for the police department's alleged role in turning over property jointly owned by Christopher and Angela Pritchard to Christopher Pritchard's family after the killing. The lawsuit alleges that action violated the Iowa Slayer Act, which prohibits a person who murdered someone from benefiting from the murder. In addition to the city itself, the lawsuit names as defendants Schroeder and officers Ryan Kloft and Shelby Mutzel. The city has yet to file a response to the lawsuit, but one of its attorneys said last week that a response will be forthcoming. And we're a little past the halfway point of the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, April 15th, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Francis, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with print disabilities. And then we're going to turn to the Insight page for today's editorials, Community Letters. First one is from Al Seabrook, Roosevelt High School class of January 1948, West Union. And he writes, first school baseball team wore minor league uniforms. Jessica and Rob Klein's history happenings in the March 31 edition brought back some fond memories that I have related to the Bunnies' successors, the Cedar Rapids Raiders. When I was a young child during the Depression of the 30s, my family didn't have money to spend on a baseball game, but we got to see many games from atop the hill west of the Roosevelt High School in Cedar Rapids. Later, during my sophomore year at Roosevelt, the parents of our Butternut Bakers, a successful Junior American Legion baseball team, petitioned the school board to allow Roosevelt to play interscholastic baseball. That was the only baseball program available to teenage boys at the time, but high school seniors were too old to compete. The parents were successful, but there was no money for equipment or uniforms. Someone who was interested in Roosevelt having a baseball team knew someone with a connection to the Cedar Rapids Raiders, one of many minor league teams suspended during World War II. Roosevelt was given the use of the Raiders' uniforms. They were adult-sized uniforms, and we looked pretty funny in them, but we could play baseball. We lost the first game of the season, 14-4, to the only public high school in Davenport at the time. We won every game after that and went on to the state high school baseball championship by beating East High School of Waterloo 1-0. Our pitcher, Al Schomburger, threw a no-hitter in that final game. And our next letter comes from Thomas Hill of Cedar Falls. And Thomas writes, the question Donald Trump's supporters must ask themselves is how they reconcile their support for him against the damning testimonies coming from those who served him and know him best. The list includes top military advisors, lawyers, economic advisors, some members of his cabinet, press officials, and campaign aides. John Kelly, a retired four-star general who served as his chief of staff, criticized Trump as having, quote, a contempt for our democratic institutions, our Constitution, and the rule of law, unquote. Trump, he said, is, quote, a person that did not want to be seen in the presence of military amputees because it didn't look good for me, and rants that our most precious heroes who gave their lives in America's defense are losers and would not visit their graves in France, unquote. Former Defense Secretary Mark Esper said Trump is not, quote, fit for office because he puts himself first, and I think anybody running for office should put the country first, unquote. Former White House counsel Ty Cobb claimed, quote, he never cared about America, its citizens, its future, or anything but himself. In fact, as history will show from his divisive lies, as well as from his unrestrained contempt for the rule of law and his related crimes, his conduct and mere existence have hastened the demise of democracy and of the nation, unquote. These assessments come from conservative Republicans who know the man intimately. Ignoring them risks turning our democracy into an autocracy governed by a lawless and vengeful leader. And that was from Thomas Hill of Cedar Falls. And then we have from George F. Will, syndicated columnist, abortion fight will ease into split the difference agreement. Although many participants in it do not recognize this, and some who do recognize it regret it, the intensity of the debate about abortion policy is waning. This is partly because, in 2022, the Supreme Court temporarily intensified the debate, and partly because the debate has been modulated by medical technology that has given the abstract debate the concreteness of visual vividness. The Supreme Court's initially divisive decision overturning its 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling has catalyzed a consensus, albeit nationally uneven and slowly emerging. The consensus is as blurry as the improved sonogram images that perhaps are helping to catalyze it are sharp. By 15 weeks, it's untenable to talk, as some abortion advocates do, about what is pictured by the sonogram as fetal material. It looks like a baby. Robert Nisbet, a philosophically sophisticated sociologist who provided intellectual ballast to conservatism in the second half of the 20th century, considered it incoherent for conservatives to make opposition to abortion a fundamental tenet of their doctrine. He said, quote, the major theme of Western conservatism is the preservation, to the extent feasible, of the autonomy of social groups against the state, unquote, and particularly the preservation of the family's authority over its own. Abortion has been considered an intractably divisive issue because it supposedly was not amenable to the basic business of politics, the splitting of differences. Nisbet noted, however, that, quote, there is no record of any religion, including Christianity, ever pronouncing an accidental miscarriage as a death to be commemorated in prayer and ritual, unquote. This, Nisbet implied, indicates an ancient, durable, and widespread cultural tendency to say this. Societies that assert an interest in protecting life before birth are not required by custom or a settled articulated logic to ban all deliberate terminations of pregnancies. This month, the Supreme Court of the nation's third most populous state allowed the legislature's recently enacted 6-week ban on abortion to go into effect next month. Before this, Florida had a moderately permissive abortion law. But the court also, and perhaps more importantly, approved a ballot initiative that this November might undo what the legislature has done. If the initiative garners 60% support, current polling shows it's got more than 60% support, it would establish a state constitutional right to abortion up to the point of viability, which is currently understood as 23 to 24 weeks. The Economist says that more than a million signatures, 150,000 reportedly from registered Republicans, launched this referendum in the state, whose 86,000 abortions in 2023 were 1/12 of the nation's total. The Economist notes that Florida has been a destination for women from neighboring states with stricter abortion limits. Quote, Florida was one of the states that saw the greatest increase in abortions following the Dobbs ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade. The state's ban will cut off nearly all access to abortion in the South, unquote. Until its recent deepening redness, Donald Trump carried it in 2016 and 2020 by 1.2 and 3.3 percentage points, respectively. Barack Obama carried it in 2008 and 2012 by 2.8 and 0.09 points, respectively. Florida was the largest swing state. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, who calls himself pro-life, has said he would sign legislation restricting abortion to the first 15 weeks. Another Republican governor, New Hampshire's pro-choice Chris Sununu, accepts his state's 24-week viability limit, and especially with each state working out its consensus. At 6 weeks, many pregnant women do not know their condition. Recently, more than 90% of U.S. abortions have occurred within the first 15 weeks of gestation. If most Republicans would reject a 6-week threshold and eschew an unconservative clamor for refederalizing the subject with a national abortion ban, the taint of extremism would shift to Democrats. Many of them insist on a right to abortion until birth, when sonograms give a disturbing, one hopes, picture of what abortion would end, and why society can at this point reasonably assert an interest in protecting the visible infant's life. Alexander Hamilton said that because the Supreme Court has neither the power of the purse nor the sword, it is the government's least dangerous branch. Actually, the court today is the uniquely powerful branch because it lacks the power of the purse or the sword, and must resort to persuasive public reasoning. Nowadays, presidents and congresses attempt this rarely and only clumsily. The debate the U.S. Supreme Court fueled 2 years ago is being ameliorative. North Dakota and South Carolina will continue to differ about abortion, but probably not forever as much as they do now. And that was from George Will, who is a syndicated columnist with the Washington Post. And our next guest column comes from Norman Sherman of Coralville. It says he's worked extensively in politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary. And Norman writes, "He can't win, but we all can lose. When your initials are Maine, are your main, possibly only qualification for running for president, you should find another hobby, maybe shoplifting in an upscale department store, or playing cello in a prep school marching band, or selling unread Donald Trump Bibles to unsuspecting minors. My thoughtful advice, if you can't make it in one of our two major parties, if you're rich enough, create your own. It may not be democracy at its best, but what difference does that make if you're a K? Robert Kennedy Jr. has somehow taken my advice without our ever meeting. Until this year, he was a Democrat. But he has created a third party out of thin air, a diminutive mass movement with millions of other people's dollars. Surprisingly, in several three-way polls, he draws about 14% of the vote, more of it from Trump than from Joe Biden. He can't win the presidency with those numbers, but he might affect who does. I once worked in a campaign for a third-party presidential candidate. He was more qualified than Kennedy Jr. or Donald Trump Sr. Farrell Dobbs was a truck driver who could walk and chew gum at the same time, something I'm not sure little Bobby can do. Farrell also had helped run a historic truck driver strike in Minneapolis. He was a man of character and real concern for others. He got about 13,000 votes out of 48 million cast in the 1948 election, but ultimately not mine. I voted for Harry Truman when I decided that a vote for Farrell, who was a friend, was wasted. If I had voted for Dobbs, it would have made no difference. Votes for third-party candidates, feel-good votes, never have in my lifetime or yours. You may remember their names. Ross Perot, Ralph Nader, Jill Stein, Henry Wallace, George Wallace, but not much more. Unfortunately, this time, Robert Kennedy Jr. may be a threat to President Biden's re-election by getting a few votes in swing states, enough to give electoral votes to Trump. Even though he has done little in public service, he carries the family name that is honored for its lives and deaths. Both his Uncle John and his father Bobby had a public service record when they ran for office. Junior has virtually none. Our current Robert has some distinction. He was expelled from two boarding schools before heading off to college. Smoking marijuana was not rare in his time, but neither was it legal or acceptable in high schools. Today, without smoking pot, he embraces crackpot theories about vaccines. For 20 years, he has encouraged anti-vaccine misinformation and conspiracy theories. Vaccines likely cause autism and are undoubtedly connected with transgender choices. If he were poor, or if his name was Sherman, God forbid, he would be dismissed as a crackpot, a con artist, or a fool. His name may honor a martyred father, whose words and actions do not. Ego overcomes family tradition in his case, and we may all suffer the consequences. It's possible that his few votes may be enough for President Biden to lose. I think his grandfather, father, and uncle would shout, "Shame." And that was from Norman Sherman of Coralville. And it says he has worked extensively in politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary. And now to today's obituaries in the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Deborah Annette Williams Chambers, age 58, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Thursday, March 21. Homegoing service will be Saturday, April 20, 2 p.m., at the New Life Outreach, which is located at 3300 42nd Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids. A private family interment will take place at a later date. Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center is in charge of arrangements, and the family asks everyone to wear purple and black in support of Deborah. Shirley May Whitty Siders, age 87, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Friday, April 12th. Memorial service, Thursday, April 18th, 2 p.m., at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will take place 1 hour prior. James Jim Brzezinski, age 71, of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 13th. Per Jim's request, the services will be private. Interment will take place at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel Mausoleum. Alan Henry Rathje, that's R-A-T-H-J-E, age 93, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, April 12th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Visitation is today from 4 to 7 at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids. Funeral service, Tuesday, April 16, 10 a.m. at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. A live stream of the funeral may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Alan. You will look under photos and videos or media starting at 10 a.m. Nancy Ruth Kuntz passed away April 6th. There will be an informal time of visiting at the Lensing Funeral Home, 605 Kirkwood Avenue in Iowa City, Wednesday, April 17, from 4 to 5:30. Casual, everyday clothes were preferred, as that is what Nancy would have preferred. Marjorie A. Miller, age 98, of Atkins, went to be with her Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, Thursday, April 11, at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids. Services, Saturday, April 20, 11 a.m., at the Tehan Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. Visitation, 10 a.m. Saturday before the service. Burial will take place in the St. Joseph Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Christy Jean Davidson, age 61, of Cedar Rapids, passed away after her courageous battle with cancer. Funeral services, Saturday, April 20, will be a visitation at the Stonebridge Church in Cedar Rapids at 3 p.m. The service will follow at the same location at 4:30. It says, in honor of Christy's bright personality, we invite you to wear any color that makes you happy. And Wendy Suzanne Schultz, born February 20, 1976, to Cora and Robert Schultz, passed away peacefully March 18th, 48 years old. A memorial service will be July 19, 11 a.m. at the St. John's Lutheran Church in Northfield, Minnesota. And turning to the sports page, a fever pitch. Indiana expected to snag Clark with number one pick in tonight's WNBA draft. This is by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Her work here is done. Well done. By early evening today, Caitlin Clark will most likely be the property of the WNBA's Indiana Fever. One of the most decorated players in women's college basketball history, Clark is the presumptive number one pick of the Fever in the WNBA draft, which begins at 6:30 p.m. on ESPN at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Can she still change her mind? Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said, joking at a news conference last Saturday, the day before the Hawkeyes lost to South Carolina in the NCAA championship game. No turning back now. There's a new world to conquer for the Dynamo from West Des Moines. Indiana was second to last in the WNBA in attendance last season at 4,067 people per game. But judging by ticket prices, both in Indianapolis and for the Fever's road games, Clark's appeal will be league-wide as soon as she hits the ground in Indy. 36 of the Fever's 40 games will be televised for the 2024 season, which begins May 14th at Connecticut. The first home game, May 16th, at the Gainbridge Fieldhouse. Other WNBA teams are also preparing to capitalize. The Minnesota Lynx scheduled Maya Moore's number retirement ceremony for the game against the Fever. Moore is one of Clark's childhood idols. The two-time defending champion Las Vegas Aces also changed the venue for their July 2nd game against the Fever to the T-Mobile Arena, which is the 20,000-seat home of the Vegas Golden Knights. Clark was a key factor in the explosion of the college women's game. The Hawkeyes sold out all of their home games last season and the majority of their road contests as well. TV numbers blew up, too, when Clark was playing, from an average of 9.9 million in last year's NCAA final to 12.3 million for the Elite Eight versus LSU, to 14.2 million Final Four versus Connecticut, to 18.7 million in the championship game versus South Carolina. All of those were women's basketball viewership records. When I think about women's basketball going forward, obviously it's just going to continue to grow, whether it's at the WNBA level or at the college level, Clark said. Everybody sees it. Everybody knows. Everybody sees the viewership numbers. Clark is the leading scorer in NCAA women's basketball history with 3,951 points, and she ranks third all-time in assists with 1,144. As you would expect from its number one draft status, Indiana is in rebuild mode. The Fever were 13-27 last season, 10th best among the league's 12 teams. Indiana's last playoff berth came in 2016. If she's with the Fever, playing with somebody like Aliyah Boston, I think they could really have fun together. I think they'll be a great 1-2 punch, Bluter said. On the other hand, Bluter added, she's going to be really tired after this season. That's what concerns me the most. Rookies go into the WNBA, which is such a challenging time, at their most exhausted time. That's a little bit unfair to them. I just know that Caitlin has stepped up to every challenge that we've posed to her. And I expect the same thing at the next level, although I know it's going to be, she's going to have to pay her rookie dues. Clark will become Iowa's third WNBA top 10 draft pick, joining Toni Foster, picked number 8 in 1997, and Samantha Logic, who was picked number 10 in 2015. And that's all the time we have today to cover the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, April 15th, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Center, or service, rather, for the blind and print handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of folks with print disabilities. You can catch podcasts of this and many of our other local programs on our website, which is iowaradioreading.org. Have a great day!